December 3rd. A grey winter morning in rural Pennsylvania. I'm in my study in my 120-year-old Victorian house, one town over from the leafy red brick liberal arts college where I teach creative writing. Behind me stretch wooden floors and ground-to-ceiling bookshelves. A steam radiator clanks in the corner. Out the window I see church steeples, slate roofs, the towering stone wall of the 19th century county jail. As a child, this muted, snowy, old-timey bookish life, surrounded by buggies and farmers' markets, would have seemed all but unimaginable, something exotic out of a C.S. Lewis novel. I grew up during the apartheid years in the Kruger National Park in northeastern South Africa, a hot, bright land of baobabs, hardy-dye ibises, and boulders. We lived in a plain ranch-style house, government housing for my father, a biologist. Sewn-up elephant legs served as end tables. The tin roof creaked in the 100-degree heat. Now in just over 2 weeks, my colleague Jenna Antonowitz, in charge of student conduct at the university, and I take 14 creative writing students back with me to my home country. Part of a new Susquehanna University program entitled Global Opportunities, the goal is to interact with a different culture and then, in a creative writing workshop, use the techniques of creative nonfiction for self-exploration. Who am I in the world? What do I see in the mirror of global difference? In a sense, students will be following, in a reverse microcosm, the route of my adult life. I grew up in South Africa, then moved after college to the United States, where the clarity that comes with cultural distance allowed me to write The Jack Bank, a memoir about South Africa. Here's our itinerary. We'll spend 5 days in Cape Town, getting a basic introduction to South African culture. We'll visit an Eastern Cape game reserve, without a certain amount of candy included with this trip. Elephant pettings, lion photographs, and the like. It's unlikely we would have been able to sign up enough students. And then, what's from my view, the core cross-cultural experience. The students will spend 6 days in Ndumbi backpackers in the traditional mud hut coastal village of Shani in the closest-speaking Eastern Cape, where 5 local guides, hired by the backpackers, will take small groups into people's homes. December 29th, JFK Airport. It's 3 days later than our expected departure. Only the first of what will be a series of real-world logistical disruptions to our educational program. The blizzard that dumped more than a foot of snow on New York City the day after Christmas caused our flight out to be cancelled. I spent the morning of December 26th on the phone to British Airways in London, getting our flights rescheduled, not an easy job at peak season for 16 people. As a result, we've had to lose 2 important activities, a mosque dinner in Cape Town and a Soweto tour during our flight connection in Johannesburg. There are different lessons, I suppose, to draw from all of this. 1. Try a course like this in May when there's less chance of these kinds of snarl-ups. But 2, this is surely in the nature of journeying. As such, it's an excellent lesson for both the students and me on how to embrace failure, essential to travel, writing, and the art of life itself. Transitory I know this world to be, says the Buddhist poet Basho. For those whose lives float away on boats, travel is home. For their part, our students still seem enthusiastic, optimistic. January 3rd, Buccaneer Backpackers, Eastern Cape, 4 days into our expedition. Neither Jenna nor I are happy with how the trip is going so far. Cape Town, with an itinerary compressed in response to the blizzard's disruptions, was a tourist whirlwind, nothing at all like Basho's slow, meditative, narrow road to the interior. Instead, it was mostly activity and entertainment, Cape Point, penguins on the beach, a jazz club. As a result, the students, who I try to remind myself daily, are at 19 and 20, still adolescents, got into kid-in-a-candy-store mode. Can anything be further from Herodotus carefully tracing the patterns of thought of the ancient Persians? From Bruce Chatwin on foot, combing the Patagonian countryside for months for stories about the exile of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid? Oh no, not a museum, they sang in unison on the cloudy afternoon we wanted to take them. Can you take us to an aquarium? Dolphins are so cute. A reminder that this trip receives university financial aid did not seem to carry much weight. So on the plane ride this morning, en route to the impoverished, thoroughly African Eastern Cape, a different world from wealthy, touristy, New Year's carnival-infused Cape Town, Jen and I asked them to write in their journals about the difference between being a tourist and a traveler. Then came this evening's check-in in the living room of one of the two student dormitories. "I feel like we haven't seen the real South Africa yet," said one student, Nate, a lanky blonde from Long Island. "Yes, I wish we had more preparation for this," said Nicole, one of the girls who in Cape Town had asked to visit the aquarium. "It's not just the Eastern Cape environment that's shocking them. The rutted roads, the huts and cattle." On the drive over, we asked students to buy gifts for their host families for the week ahead, prompting protests that they had simply no idea how to buy presents for people and a culture they hadn't yet met. "Next time we do this, we'll structure this more sensibly, with the hard work, the Shawnee Village cultural immersion, as well as the mosque visits and dialogues at the beginning, and the jazz club and penguins at the end, like a final day class party." January 5th. So we've just stumbled into Mdumbi backpackers, muddy, sodden, exhausted. Our shoes are soaked. Our clothes and arms are plastered with dirt. Upon arrival, after an epic four-hour-long hike along ocean cliffs and through rivers and mud hut villages, I had to step directly into a meeting with the five waiting guides, Tati, Senzo, Royko, Tony, and Jay. They were appropriately bemused at the spectacle of an American professor, in shorts and t-shirt, plastered with mud and with bramble scratches over his arms, talking to them about course goals. The idea of this hike, an optional activity but something most of the students chose to do, came from the backpackers' lodge. "An excellent introduction to the region," they said. I agreed. The 8-mile hike, known as Hole in the Wall, is one of South Africa's most famous. One of the assistant directors here, Lusanda, does it several times a week, there and back, when he heads to the tourist hamlet of Coffee Bay for grocery shopping. The yellow-dotted hills and sweeping coastal vistas appear in 1,000 postcards and getaway magazine photo shoots. I thought the walk would provide students with a superb overview of the geographical, natural, and cultural environment they'd be intensively researching for the next week. But there were two things I failed to factor in. One, the average fitness level of the contemporary American student, and two, the effect of 4 weeks of recent heavy rain. So what should have been a moderately challenging hike turned into an Odyssean challenge. At one time we flailed through a scrub tunnel on a slippery smooth mud morass at a 60-degree incline. The only way to get up was by treading on the guide's boot and letting early ascenders pull one up to safety. "This sucks," said Andrew, a male student covered in mud from head to foot. "This really sucks." Another time we clung to coastal scrub to avoid slipping on rocks overhanging a wave-pummeled inlet. About two-thirds of the way into the hike, we forded a waist-deep river. Another time the guide had to hold off a pack of barking dogs. This is what Sarah, one student, says about the experience.
"Well, I've always had breathing problems, so even the very steep up and down was really difficult for me. But then, since it had been raining so much, there were mudslides, and it was hard to stand, even, especially towards the beginning. And then we got to a point where the river was up so high that we had to swim across it, and we had to scale a cliff. We were walking on these wet rocks. And
that was terrifying. That was very scary.
It was very scary, and it was very difficult. But once we got here, I felt very good about having finished it."
And the adversity seems to have brought us together. Now, after hot showers and warm food, I notice a newfound jauntiness in the student's step. "When do we get started?" several of them have been asking. Melville, Faulkner, Thoreau, and Hemingway were all outdoor adventure writers, argues Tim Cahill in his introduction to the best American travel writing of 2006. He might, of course, have added Mark Twain. Adventure can be literate. Among its virtues, it sharpens the senses, forces a writer to pay close attention to her surroundings. Although I'm not sure I'll take a group through an experience precisely like this again, at least not in the aftermath of a subtropical flood, this trial by water has bonded the students for the cross-cultural challenges ahead. January 8th. It's our third day at Dumdumbi Backpackers. Here's what our first 2 days have looked like. Breakfast at 8:30 a.m. A gloriously late beginning to the day in what seems to us, let's face it, a seaside paradise. From the tin roof of Dumbi Cafe, thick, rough-hewn wooden tables, and African bead necklaces hanging down from the ceiling, we can hear surf and birdsong. Afterwards, the students set out in groups of three with their guides, who introduce them to activities like mud brick making and dung floor maintenance, and who take them to visit families. The afternoons are free time, which students spend mostly on the beach. And then in the evenings we gather for check-ins, discussion, and writing exercises designed to prompt reflection on the human element of the interactions they've been having. Thus far, the group seem to be either succeeding magnificently or struggling tremendously, with no one in the middle. The first category consists of those that have had the benefit of either my presence or that of one of the older translator guides. Tati and Jay, in their late 20s, are local teachers, and they have perfect instincts. Tati suggests open-ended interview questions, and Jay comes up with games and icebreakers. The three groups that haven't been doing so well all have young male teenage guides who, while familiar with Xhosa culture and relatively fluent in English, seem a bit at a loss in the role of social facilitator. I've heard stories of conversations running into long awkward silences, interrupted by the guides hurrying the group along. Interestingly, my colleague Jenna says she's been struggling too. A skilled and eloquent workshop facilitator back in Pennsylvania, here though, she feels boxed out by extreme cultural difference, cattle and goats on these gravel roads, women carrying bundles of firewood on their heads.
I had an amazing opportunity to work with two of our students, Allison and Kim, as we went through the Shawnee village with our guide Senso. When we were there, I don't know that he fully understood the purpose of our visit because he had a lot of opportunities given to us to carry water on our heads and sticks and help hoe in the garden and a lot of different chores around the house, which was cool for the first day or so. And then after a while, when it seemed pretty clear that we weren't actually helping anyone, we were really just getting the photo op, we decided to pull in some of our help with Glenn and see if he could help us get some conversation started. And it was a little tough because we couldn't understand him, and the more frustrated we got trying to understand him, I think the more we retreated, and it was like we were brain dead. We couldn't think of any questions, and I kept telling myself, Jenna, if you met someone on the subway of New York City, you could talk to them for hours. This is the same thing. Talk about your interests. Talk about different things. And it was really quite a challenge.
So this morning I've joined Jenna, Kim, Allison, and their rather taciturn guide, Sanzo. We're striding up a gravel road towards the northern end of Shawnee Village, and I'm making small talk with him about sports. He likes both soccer and rugby. His educational background, he finished 12th grade, and about his family's collection of goats and cattle. As I do so, I notice that, although I speak only a few words of Xhosa more than most Americans, and although I grew up lily-white and Anglophile, I am really still at an enormous advantage relative to them. Were you taking maths for your matric subject? I asked Sanzo. In doing so, I noticed myself changing, without having consciously intended to do so, not only my inflection and accent, but also my grammar, vocabulary, and syntax. Yes, he says, I like it. Whenever Jenna, Allison, or Kim asks Senzo anything, he begs them to repeat as many as 5 or 6 times. By speaking this African pidgin English, though, I can make myself instantly understood. We get to our informant's house, the local Sangoma, or medicine man, Special Masiso. When we arrive, he's busy with another student in the garden, talking, no doubt, about medicinal herbs and barks. Special's wife, who introduces herself as Nontandazo, shows Senzo, Jenna, Kim, Allison, and me into Special's consultancy, around dung floor mud huts to one side of his compound. We sit on the floor, on a grass mat. On a table against the wall lie a collection of beaded medicine jars on a yellow tablecloth. Nontandazo, a slender, beautiful young woman, wearing a plain brown t-shirt, checkered blue skirt, and a knotted green headcloth, takes up a seat behind a drum positioned in the center of the room. Sangoma will be coming soon, says Senzo, and silence descends. Now, as we wait for Special to finish in the garden with the other group, I realize we have a unique opportunity. As soon as Special arrives, he'll be the African patriarch and will answer all questions first. Nontandaza will defer to him. This is a chance to get her unedited stories. So I nod at Kim and Allison, who are looking down at their feet and seem at a loss. They nod hello again to Nontandaza, who smiles at them shyly. Do you guys have any questions for Nontandaza? How many children do you have? Kim asks. 3. Allison, how did you meet Sangoma? She shrugs, giggles softly again, and silence descends again. Outside, a dog barks. The students are being much too direct and businesslike. As at a cocktail party at the Guggenheim, there's a need to be garrulous and chatty before getting personal. I'm going to jump in. How did you meet your husband? Jenna, I ask. The old Truman Capote trick. Tell an informant something personal about yourself, and then she'll be more likely to open up. I talk about meeting my own partner, Peterson Toscano, but I fear introducing the gay issue at a moment like this could turn into a major distraction. It was easy, explains Jenna, rising to the occasion. We met through work. When Jenna shared her tale about going on one of her first dates with her partner to a birthday party I threw with South African foods like bobotie and bredi, Nontandaza nods with interest as we talk about them, again revealing the usefulness of finding common reference points. I go back to gently teasing and probing her about her own life. I can see there's a story about you and Special, I tell her. She smiles. Can we start guessing? Maybe you saw each other across the fields. She laughs happily now. Maybe you sat next to each other in church. Even more merriment. A playful, flirtatious spirit has entered the room, and now the students are all starting to feel comfortable too, making up stories to entertain Nontandaza. Perhaps Special spotted her on the way back from the Jabulani African store down the street from the backpackers and liked her purchases. By the time Special gets back in from the front garden and gives us a lecture on traditional medicine before leading us in a traditional song and dance to invoke the ancestors, the four of us will have heard about how Nontandaza is, like her husband, a Sangoma, how much she loves to collect plants and keep people entertained in the consultancy while they wait for him, how thrilled she was to become a mother. Special will later fill us in on how their marriage was prompted by an unplanned pregnancy. In short, we'll have things to write about her. Over the course of this week, as I join different groups like this one, this is what I will come to see as my prime role as cross-cultural educator and travel writing coach. Forget theory. Forget sensitivity training. Like a garrulous Upper East Side socialite, my main task will be to act cheerful and delighted, to flutter out vapid but entertaining questions. What vegetable can't you stand eating? What would happen if a goat got in the house? When there's a dance or song, I won't sit stiff and self-conscious like the students, watching. I'll gleefully make a fool of myself and jump up and down holding a spear. The more the closer villagers laugh at the absurdity of my efforts, the better the quality of the interview that will follow. According to Ryszard Kapuscinski, Herodotus, the world's first known travel writer, must have been a cheerful, relaxed, kind man because, quote, it is only to such people that strangers reveal their secrets, end quote. Nobody opens up to a self-conscious person. Herodotus, Kapuscinski tells us, loved the dinner table and the fireplace, the Socratic to and fro of ancient knights on the road. These villagers live lives not too different from those of ancient Greeks. Entertainment here, too, consists of talk and laughter, something I know and remember by instinct from having grown up near people very similar to these. If there is a single skill our students will need to succeed as travel writers in this particular place, it is just to relax. January 11th, our last day in Umdumbi, and we're praying a courtesy call to the local traditional chief, Vulishlanga Sikwayawu. This is something I know that one does as an outsider in rural areas. Backpackers can stop in an African village, visit the headman, and receive cheap or free accommodation with the local family. Wise development workers pay tribute to the chief before sinking a borehole or building a marine research station.
Siyathanda i-visit bazifike apha kuMangosi.
We love the visitors to arrive here in this village of Mangosi.
Ka abazifike. But they don't introduce the visitors to me.
But we messed up on this trip. A long story involving transport problems and booked up calendars, but the bottom line is that we're here, 6 days into our visit, sitting in a hut and being reprimanded by a minor royal. His eyebrows furrow when he looks in my direction, the teacher's. He talks about how he'd love visitors to be introduced here at the beginning of their travels. He blames the managers of the backpackers for not communicating enough with him. He talks about a separation between his hilltop office and the traveler center down below on the shores of the ocean. I try to be conciliatory, thank him profusely for his hospitality and kindness, and apologize for our tardiness. It comes out sounding awkward and defensive, though. But then the students rescue me. This is Nicole.
Just being here has just been a complete pleasure in every sense of the way. Everyone has just been very friendly, very accommodating. Even considering our language barriers and stuff, we've all gotten along very well. And I feel like I have, but he was talking before about bonding with people, and I feel like I really have bonded with some people despite our language barriers, because, like he was saying before, we are just all the same people. And it's just very, very interesting seeing the way you all live in comparison with the way we live in America. It's very different, but it's very interesting in a good way.
Chief Uli Schlange is visibly delighted. This is so grown-up and magnanimous. I believe in friendship, he tells us now, talking through one of our interpreters. If you came looking for friendship, you found it here in my office. Please come back anytime you like. The students have gone from tourists to travelers, from awkward guests to sophisticated cross-cultural ambassadors. I'm proud of them. January 13th. JFK Airport again. Home, the logical end of every travel narrative. Now students join their families for a few days' rest before the spring semester begins. Once classes start, the 15 of us will meet once a week in a basement seminar room beneath an embankment of colorful posters for visiting writers. Mary Carr will look down on us over a full-volume set of the Oxford English Dictionary. Students will hold printed manuscripts with line edits on them, and will ask each other questions like, what's emotionally at stake in the story? As always, the hardest part of the writing journey will be the drafting and redrafting, the painstaking attention to thought and language, the excruciating structural choices about what to exclude. Answer, as in any memoir, almost everything. What will be left are a few small but illuminating glimpses. Hopefully, what these students will carry away with them, though, will be lessons that go beyond that of a regular creative writing workshop, focusing on craft and technique.
And this is just my personal thing, so maybe it doesn't make any sense, but I feel like you need to, as a writer, you need to learn more about the world. I feel like that's an essential part of writing, and then if you can at all, to go see it, and by seeing and by experiencing it, you learn more about the world, and you learn more about yourself that way, and I feel like the more that you know yourself, the more that you know how you react to certain things, the more truth you can put in your writing, and the better it'll be. So for me, I feel like this opportunity is not only fantastic in the aesthetic sense that it's just beautiful and amazing and it's been an adventure, but it's also vital to the way that we write and the way that we will write when we get back to SU.
Glenn Retief teaches at Susquehanna University. His memoir, The Jack Bank, is forthcoming from St. Martin's Press.